Part 5, Psychology. Diagnoses. On January 9th, 1992, 1 year after being apprehended and a few days before her trial for the murder of Richard Mellery began, Dr. Harry Kropp analyzed and diagnosed Eileen with borderline personality disorder, with paranoid features. Dr. Bernard, the state's expert psychologist, also diagnosed her with BPD, as well as antisocial personality disorder, ASPD, acknowledging that her upbringing, mental challenges, and alcoholism were factors in her impaired development. However, both agreed that she was competent to stand trial and understood the charges that she was facing and their consequences. Dr. Bernard had noted that Eileen had an IQ of 81, based on findings from her junior high performance, which is in the lower range and almost at the point of being intellectually disabled, which is IQ 70 to 75. Three defense psychologists agreed that Eileen suffered from BPD and would have suffered with extreme emotional and psychological disturbance at the time of her crimes. She scored 32 out of 40 on a psychopathy test, which confirmed her diagnosis of ASPD. A score above 25 indicates psychopathy. While several psychologists acknowledged Eileen's traumatic childhood as an underlying factor for her behavior, the fact that she had only started to murder beyond the age of 30 reduced the significance of it, much to her disadvantage. Her criminal behavior had escalated over time, starting with the illegal activity of prostitution, and later evolving into armed robbery, auto theft, and murder. They also noted that, besides BPD and ASPD, which are personality disorders, Eileen did not have a history of mental illness. During her murder spree, there was also no obvious trigger. Eileen did not recall the events in a way that showed any amount of dissociation, traumatic flashbacks, or memory gaps. In fact, she was clear in communicating her intent to eliminate witnesses after robbing them and insisted to psychologists that she killed her victims in cold blood. In July 1992, Dr. Kropp had become increasingly concerned with Eileen's beliefs that she was at the center of an expansive conspiracy theory, which involved everyone that she was in contact with, including her lawyers, the police, her adoptive mother, and the prison staff. He wrote a letter to Stephen Glazer, her inexperienced attorney at the time, stating that she had manifested a full-blown delusional system, something that Glazer seemed to use to his advantage to keep Eileen on a noose. Dr. Kropp had assessed the development of a persecutory type of delusional disorder, which was getting worse over time. Based on this, Dr. Donald Delbito and Dr. Joel Epstein were tasked with assessing whether she was mentally competent to stand her remaining trials. Both diagnosed her with borderline personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder, and acknowledged her paranoid ideation. However, they did not find her to be mentally incompetent, saying that while she pleaded to be put to death as soon as possible was tragic, it was not psychotic or delusional. On August 6, 1992, Dr. Epstein confirmed that her reasoning was logical and goal-orientated, where she had accepted her fate and did not want to delay the consequences of her actions. Interestingly, Eileen underwent a Rorschach test, where she was shown a variety of ink blots and asked to relay what she saw. From her responses, they deduced that she was narcissistic, self-centered, and overvalued her own personal worth. Dr. Epstein said, "Her thinking and reasoning abilities, however, do not appear to reflect any pathological processes, but are seen as that of an immature or unsophisticated individual," which is what her first defense attorney, Tricia Jenkins, had observed when Eileen sat giggling in court. On December 10, 1992, two court-appointed mental health experts, Dr. Sidney Merrin and Dr. Daniel Spree, were tasked with analyzing her before the penalty phase of her final trial. Dr. Spree found that while Eileen suffered from BPD, a long-standing personality disorder, she was not mentally incompetent and understood the implications of her sentence. All eight mental health professionals agreed that at no time did Eileen not know right from wrong, even when she had committed her crimes. They observed that she had immersed herself in religion while in prison, but noted that it was not uncommon for inmates to do. And of course, Not one psychologist had witnessed her talk about the abuse or suffering throughout her life. To them, it seemed that she was simply ungovernable in her youth and showed no signs of reform, even when the resources were provided to her. When questioned about her mental state in court, based on her dramatic outbursts, laughter, and performance, she said that she had just been blowing off steam because she felt frustrated that she was being paraded around like a freak in court. While it cannot be denied that Eileen suffered from all forms of abuse in her life, psychologists were not able to link her experiences with her behavior or character, confirming that the only thing that she suffered from was a borderline personality disorder. While her background and lack of education may have facilitated her path into prostitution, Eileen had already been selling her body to boys in the community when she was still living at home, starting as young as the age of 9. Let's take a closer look at her diagnosis. Borderline Personality Disorder. Source: nimh.nih.gov. Borderline personality disorder is an illness marked by an ongoing pattern of varying moods, self-image, and behavior. These symptoms often result in impulsive actions and problems in relationships. People with borderline personality disorder may experience intense episodes of anger, depression, and anxiety that can last from a few hours to days. They may experience mood swings and display uncertainty about how they see themselves and their role in the world. As a result, their interests and values can change quickly. People with borderline personality disorder also tend to view things in extremes, such as all good or all bad. Their opinions of other people can also change quickly. An individual who is seen as a friend one day may be considered an enemy or a traitor the next. These shifting feelings can lead to intense and unstable relationships. Other signs or symptoms may include efforts to avoid real or imagined abandonment, such as rapidly initiating intimate, physical or emotional relationships, or cutting off communication with someone in anticipation of being abandoned. A pattern of intense and unstable relationships with family, friends, and loved ones, often swinging from extreme closeness and love, idealization, to extreme dislike or anger, devaluation. Distorted and unstable self-image or sense of self. Impulsive and often dangerous behaviors, such as spending sprees, unsafe sex, substance abuse, reckless driving, and binge eating. Please note, if these behaviors occur primarily during a period of elevated mood or energy, there may be signs of a mood disorder and not borderline personality disorder. Self-harming behavior, recurring thoughts of suicidal behaviors or threat, intense and highly changeable moods with each episode lasting from a few hours to a few days, chronic feelings of emptiness, inappropriate intense anger or problems controlling anger, difficulty trusting, which is sometimes accompanied by irrational fear of other people's intentions, feelings of dissociation, such as feeling cut off from oneself, seeing oneself from outside one's body, or feelings of unreality. Not everyone with borderline personality disorder experiences every symptom. Some individuals experience only a few symptoms, while others have many. In Eileen's case, we can observe that she had experienced almost all of these symptoms in her life, right up until the day that she was executed. In her letters to her friend Dawn, she frequently shifted between idealizing people and demonizing them, usually cutting people off if she felt that her needs were not being met. On one hand, people did exploit her, but on the other, she seemed to resent anyone that she could not successfully manipulate into serving her own purposes. Eileen had attempted to take her own life on at least 2 occasions, and possibly, according to her, up to 6 times, once shooting herself in the stomach when a relationship with a boyfriend had ended. While there was no evidence of her self-harming in the form of cutting, she abused alcohol, recklessly spent any money she could get her hands on, drove dangerously, and allowed men to do whatever they wanted to her body. Her temper had been a problem since childhood, which was described as impulsive and uncontrollable, where she could be enraged one minute and happy the next. Her genetics, environment, and brain function contributed to the development of BPD, a disorder for which there is no cure, even though treatment may help to ease some of the symptoms. Unfortunately, Eileen grew up in a time where not only was it not the normal thing to do to go and see a shrink, but research for how to treat BPD was still developing. Antisocial Personality Disorder, ASPD. Source, pubmed.ncbi.nlm.nih.gov. Antisocial Personality Disorder, ASPD, is a deeply ingrained and rigid dysfunctional thought process that focuses on social irresponsibility with exploitive, delinquent, and criminal behavior with no remorse. Disregard for and the violation of others' rights are common manifestations of this personality disorder, which displays symptoms that include failure to conform to the law, inability to sustain consistent employment, deception, manipulation for personal gain, and incapacity to form stable relationships. The following are criteria to be diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. A pervasive pattern of disregard for and violation of the rights of others since age 15 years, as indicated by three or more of the following. Failure to conform to social norms concerning lawful behaviors, such as performing acts that are grounds for arrest. Deceitfulness, repeated lying, use of aliases, or conning others for pleasure or personal profit. Impulsivity or failure to plan. Irritability and aggressiveness, often with physical fights or assaults. Reckless disregard for the safety of self or others. Consistent irresponsibility, failure to sustain consistent work behavior or honor monetary obligations. Lack of remorse, being indifferent to or rationalizing having hurt, mistreated, or stolen from another person. The individual is at least age 18 years. Evidence of conduct disorder, typically with onset before age 15 years. The occurrence of antisocial behavior is not exclusively during schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. It's fairly obvious why Eileen was diagnosed with ASPD. While people had used and abused her throughout her life, she too had learned to exploit, deceive, and manipulate others her entire life, based on her unhealthy attachments in her youth. Before she had become a serial killer, she had spent time in jailhouses and correctional institutions for committing several felonies with a primary motive of gaining money, which included armed robbery, vandalism, harassment, and prostitution. She had also used a variety of aliases in her adult life, including using a relative's name to pawn off her murder victim's belongings. While many have empathized with her overwhelming need for survival based on her circumstances, Eileen clearly had no regard for the law and little regard for others, as much as we try to see past that. She owned a variety of guns, assaulted several men in her young adult life, drove for years without a driver's license, shoplifted when she needed something, threatened people with violence when she didn't get her way, and seemed to treat all of her interactions with others as unemotional trade-offs, as obsessed and in love as she may have said she was. People with ASPD generally do not like to play by the rules unless they are threatened with punishment, but for Eileen, even capital punishment did not sway her to follow the correct procedures. She hired and fired a string of attorneys, swore at the judge and jury in court, waived her right to even be present when she knew that she would not get away, and stubbornly sat in her cell on death row writing frantic letters to her friend, which also shifted between warm and hostile over the years. In some letters, she was funny, friendly, and asking politely for her friend to do things for her, example, buying her a radio, sending her money, connecting her with media representatives who could tell her side of the story, and communicating with people that she was not writing to. While in others, she was degrading, cold, and filled with resentment and rage. Throughout their interaction, and almost all of the interactions she ever had, she was the one who called the shots. She also struggled to plan anything in advance, mostly living day to day without a clear vision of the alternative lifestyle and relationship choices that she could have made. For her, every day became about survival and gambling not only with her own life and security, but also with others, until she got to the place where it felt like it was her or the other person who was going to die. The pressure of living such a quick fix, risky life ended up costing her everything, including her life. Childhood. Eileen was born on February 29, 1956, a leap year day, and ironically entered the world bottom first with her feet up near her head, experiencing her first moments of life in a stressful environment as doctors tried to ensure that she would survive her birth. Her mother, Diane, was a teenager who had already been divorced for 2 months before she had Eileen, her second child. There is little information about Keith and Eileen's foundational years of life, but based on how their mother had discarded them before they were 5 years old, one can be certain that she was not overly maternal or attached to them, which is devastating for the developing mind of a child. There was also no sign of their father. He had left the home to serve in the army, agreed to divorce Diane, and was never seen again. This turned out to be a good thing, seeing as he turned out to be a child rapist who suffered from schizophrenia and took his own life in prison. Perhaps the kids would have been even worse off had their parents stayed married. Eileen and her brother were, at first, handed over to Diane's cousins and were later dropped off at their grandparents' house, who had two children of their own. To have moved around so much and change hands in such a short space of time was the opposite of the love, nurturing, and care that they needed in their most vulnerable stage of life. Did they have toys, teddies, warm and comfortable beds, healthy food? According to Eileen, her grandmother, who she believed was her mother until she was 7, while strict, took care of them and played with them in the garden, showed them insects, birds, and garden creatures, and made sure that they were bathed, fed, and had their basic needs taken care of. The problem was, it was not consistent, based on both grandparents struggling with alcoholism and wafting in and out of mental clarity as they raised 4 kids. When her grandfather was drunk, he took his rage out on the 2 misfits of the house, enraged that they were the product of Leo Pittman, the criminal that their daughter had created the little monsters with. While Eileen's story shifted significantly between being raised in a clean and decent household and being beaten black and blue with a razor belt, her childhood friends were able to verify that she and Keith were severely beaten by their grandfather, usually with a razor belt, after being forced to strip naked. Eileen and Keith likely did not behave as well as Barry and Laurie, based on their initial phases of development lacking any structure, discipline, or love. Sadly, the lack of parenting on Diane and Leo's part ended up costing their children, where their ex-army sergeant of a grandfather decided that the only way to correct their behavior was through violence. Forensic psychologist Dr. David Holmes said, "On a daily basis, the strict regime that he imposed became quite militaristic. He was quite vicious. The beatings were very regular. It was done in a ritual manner. She would have to actually clean the strap that she was beaten with, and she was beaten in quite a pseudo-sexual way. This may have loosened her morals, but then again, they may have been loosened already." The physical abuse stopped when they found out that they were adopted. Eileen allegedly told her grandfather that because he was not even their real father, he had no right to beat them. Somehow, this stirred some guilt in him, and he stopped beating them, instead punishing them by grounding them like his own 2 children were used to. But they still had to call him Sir, and would get a bar of soap in their mouths if anyone caught them swearing, at least an upgrade from what they were used to. Dr. Helen Morrison, the infamous American forensic psychiatrist, who has John Wayne Gacy's brain and other organs stored in her basement, said, "She didn't have a healthy relationship with anybody, male or female. There was never a sense of attachment emotionally to anyone. There was never any sense of safety or security, which most people need desperately." When Eileen was 9 years old and Laurie, her stepsister and biological aunt, was 11, they often hung out together and played in the nature surrounding their home. Eileen said that she had always felt a sense of protection over Laurie and that she naturally looked out for her, but Laurie did not really reciprocate. On one occasion, they had come across some flammable liquid in an empty duck shed adjacent to their house, which seemed like a lot of fun to play with at the time. Having underestimated its power, they were soon bolting out of a burning shed, where Laurie received minor burns on her legs, and Eileen received first, second, and third degree burns all over her body, including her head, that she spent 3 days in the hospital for. This incident destroyed her hair, and she said that since that day, her hair had never grown properly again. According to her friends, she became obsessed with brushing and caring for her hair as best she could, a ritual that was still evident on death row when she was interviewed by Nick Broomfield. It is unclear at what age Eileen started to explore her own body or had been sexually violated, but it was long before she had gone into puberty. One of her childhood friends, Cindy Chauvin-Dalmage, said that she had witnessed Eileen confronting her family about the sexual abuse she was suffering from her brothers, but instead of listening to what she had to say, they threw a glass of water in her face and kicked her out of the house. She had said that she wished that Barry, who was 12 years older than her, would stop coming into her room at night, but her complaints had fallen on deaf and drunk ears, and nothing was done about it. Within 3 years of finding out that they were adopted and essentially discarded by their own parents, Eileen and Keith started experimenting with each other sexually, which was evidently a coping mechanism. Perhaps this was also Eileen's way of getting Barry to back off and help her to find the unconditional love and acceptance that she was not getting anywhere else. In her child mind, who better than her own brother, the other rugrat of the family who had suffered in a similar way? When kids in the community started noticing, Keith shrugged it off in a way that unfortunately objectified the young blonde Eileen and seemed to create the impression in other boys' minds that her body was available for experimentation. They approached her with things that they knew she could not turn down, such as food, cigarettes, and alcohol, and one by one took advantage of her, using her for sexual satisfaction and practice, labeling her as the Sig Pig. Having already suffered the self-image blows in her home, Eileen's self-worth was shattered to the point where she believed that her value was determined by the small comforts that she earned from offering sexual favors. There was no one to teach her otherwise. Her view of the world was one-sided, where it all became a game of what you could give and what you could get, without any regard for one another. Most of what she was after were things that she could instantly soothe and numb herself with, a habit that followed her throughout her life, including cigarettes, booze, marijuana, prescription pills, food, and maybe even some much-needed affection. When children are not given the appropriate touch and affection that they need, they often resort to finding inappropriate ways to meet that need, and unfortunately, there are more predators available for this than one might initially expect in every phase of life. This cycle had a snowball effect, where the consequences of selling herself out included escalated aggression at home, increased alcohol consumption, accepting offers from older boys and eventually men, isolating herself from her peers, performing poorly at school, and derailing her entire life to the point where she could no longer survive. Some of her childhood friends recalled how much Eileen was bullied and abused in her youth, and how they felt sorry for her. Even though they had no capacity for knowing what to do to help her, there was not one person in Eileen's life who protected her from harm, especially in her childhood, which is why she became the independent tyrant that she was known to be in later life. She was not going to take orders from anybody because she never had anyone to look up to or listen to before, at least not in her best interest. She was in fact so neglected in her childhood, which is a terrible form of abuse, that she had no sense of what self-care even meant. She had learned to totally neglect herself and therefore had no capacity to relate to, connect with, or trust anyone else. One of her classmates, Karen Gamble, from Troy Union Elementary School, said that Eileen always sat quietly by herself, totally withdrawn and unable to relate to her peers. She struggled with selective hearing in class, something that could have been a form of dissociation caused by stress and was likely a skill that she had learned at home, where she was able to block out certain sounds while tuning into others. Unfortunately, it only served her negatively in school, and slowly but surely, she withdrew completely. Karen said she looked scared and lonely and usually sat on the step by the door leading back to class. While Eileen enjoyed biking, swimming, hanging out, and singing along to her favorite songs, her childhood had dissolved prematurely, and by the time she became a teenager, she might as well have been an adult. The problem was, by becoming a woman so soon, she had stunted her development and cut her life short because of the choices she would make with her immature but corrupted mind. Adolescence. Psychologists noted that Eileen had developed signs of antisocial personality disorder, ASPD, in her adolescence, where she bunked school, abused substances, traded sex for material things, and did not respond well to authority figures. The school had allegedly advised her parents, who were her biological grandparents, that she needed counseling, but their advice was ignored. When she was 14, she got knocked up by a disgusting community pedophile that liked to have all the kids take turns to sit on his lap at parties that he would host for them. Eileen responded well to his advances, believing that the trade-off was reasonable. She could listen to her favorite records at his house, and he could have sex with her. No biggie. Except that he managed to get her pregnant, which devastated her life beyond repair. For 6 months, she hid her pregnancy from her parents, which must have taken significant effort to do. When she told them, they were infuriated. She had quite literally repeated the pattern of her mother by getting pregnant at the age of 14 and also by a criminal type like her father. Interestingly, Eileen's father was also a pedophile who went to prison for kidnapping and sodomizing a child. It's strange how cycles repeat in families, as much as we all try to avoid it. She was forced to drop out of school in the 9th grade and to go to a home for unwed mothers in Detroit, where she gave birth to a 7-pound baby boy that she never got to hold. Because of her age, he was immediately put up for adoption. Enter Dawn Botkins, a friend of Lori Grody's, Eileen's stepsister and biological aunt, who felt tremendous empathy for her for being even more isolated following her pregnancy. She said that the kids bullied her even more and that she had become the local untouchable, but Dawn knew that despite her promiscuity and unpredictable temper, Eileen had a soft side. As much as Eileen tried to become popular at school by doing all the wrong things, having sex with boys, drinking, arranging parties, and fighting when she needed to, she became more of an outcast with every effort that she made and started running away from home. On one occasion, Eileen was the proud host of a house party that her parents allowed her to have, where she prepared snacks and drinks for everyone, excited that for once she would be accepted by her peers. But sadly, Barry had influenced her friends to throw her out into the cold, literally, which Dawn said was awful to witness because it brutally annihilated her confidence. By the second or third time that she had run away from home, her grandfather had arranged for her to be captured like a stray dog and sent to Pontiac's Juvenile Hall and then to Adrian Girls Training School, a reformatory. She did not respond well to this and tried to escape on several occasions, running like a wild hog through barbed wire and bush, where she was caught in a state that required medical attention. By the time Eileen was 15, she had told her grandfather that she hated his guts, and he had told the court that he wanted nothing to do with her, leaving her to fend for herself in the woods. Tragically, her grandmother would die from liver cirrhosis in the same year from her excessive drinking, even though her grandfather decided that the stress that Eileen and Keith had caused them was the reason for her death. He kicked them out of the home and sunk into grief, depression, and mental illness, where he tried to take his own life in the basement. In 1976, by the time Eileen was 20, he completed suicide in his son's garage. When Eileen was kicked out of the family home at the age of 15, she did not cry, seek help, or tell anyone at school. Instead, she slept in the woods or abandoned cars and got ready for school every day, which was somewhat admirable. She chose a spot to rest not too far from home, possibly hoping that at some point the outcome would change and she would be let back in, but she never was. Her grandfather and his children, Lori and Barry, agreed that the root cause of all of their problems were Diane's children, Keith and Eileen. At the age of 15, Eileen was forced to survive in the wild, which included sleeping in the snow in the cold Michigan winters, finding food, washing up at gas stations, combing her frazzled hair, and thumbing it or walking to wherever she needed to go. This was unlike anything that her neighborhood had ever seen. In fact, Troy was known as a quiet and relatively sophisticated town, where the streets were lined with pretty post boxes, trees, and freshly painted homes. When she was 16, Eileen decided that she needed to leave her hometown, mostly because of the cold weather, and headed towards Florida. For a while, she thrived in Colorado amongst the biker gangs, but after getting in trouble with the law, needed to keep heading westward to warm, sunny Florida. While she had traveled extensively across America between the age of 16 and 19, sometimes working as a cook, maid, cashier, and pool hustler, she decided to settle in Florida, where she could enjoy the beaches, warm weather, and newfound freedom without any attachments or responsibilities, while still offering her lean, youthful body as a sex object to salivating men. Adulthood. When Eileen got to Florida, she met a 69-year-old man who promised to take good care of her, giving her a diamond ring to claim her as his own. She said yes and proudly posed for pictures with her sugar daddy, probably thinking that she struck gold or made it, even though in the back of her mind she must have wondered if it was all too good to be true. A pattern of self-sabotage is common in sufferers of BPD, and Eileen was no exception. Instead of embracing the safety that she had found for herself and playing it cool with an old man who was in awe of her, she started hitting the bars, and eventually also hitting men in the head with cue balls, which got her arrested for assault and disorderly conduct. Within weeks, Eileen had demanded more pocket money, than Lewis was willing to give her. He was likely keeping her on a shorter leash than she had anticipated, probably for her own good, but discipline and good behavior were not her style. Lewis also revealed his sexual fantasies to her, which grossed her out and got him beaten with his own cane. In return, he decided to annul the marriage and kicked his stray back onto the street where she belonged. It's fascinating to think that she would have rather beaten an old man for whatever his kinky desires entailed than play nice, like she had as a prostitute. Surely her clients were equally, if not more, disgusting. And instead of a fistful of dollars for a quick sex act, she would be rewarded with yacht cruises, good food, gorgeous places to rest her head, and all the health and beauty care that she could have ever dreamed of. But it wasn't to be. Eileen chose to return to a life of street hustling, where she struggled to live, eat, and take care of herself every day since she left him. 1976 was a bad year for her, even though she had just settled in Florida with high hopes of a new life. She was freshly divorced when she found out that her grandfather had killed himself in the garage and her brother Keith had died of throat cancer, which was a devastating blow. While they had gone separate ways after being kicked out of the family home as teenagers, they were still extremely close, and Eileen could not forgive herself for not knowing how sick he had become since she had left. She returned to Michigan to see him before he died and to attend his funeral, where their biological mother also appeared, as well as some other family members and friends, including Dawn. Eileen was there with one mission in mind, to get his ashes and leave. In honor of their bond, Keith had left her $10,000 in life insurance and given her the rights to collect and scatter his ashes, which she did. She so vividly remembered the experience that she asked her friend Dawn if she could be scattered in the same area when she died. While she never expressed it, she may have suffered from survivor's guilt at the time and debated with herself what her purpose on earth was without the one person who she had always counted on for unconditional love and support. He was gone, and by the time Eileen was 22, she wanted to be gone too. After breaking up with a boyfriend, she took a .22 caliber pistol, drove to the beach, and shot herself in the stomach, a suicide attempt that she survived and was treated in the hospital for. Interestingly, she had also shot most of her victims in the stomach, aiming for the same vital organs that she had once wanted to obliterate in herself. 1 week later, she attempted to take her own life again by overdosing on tranquilizers, but also survived that. As obvious as her mental health issues were, she did not receive any support, treatment, or advice about it, nor was she given any counseling for trying to take her own life, which she said had happened 4 more times before these 2 attempts. When she was 25, she had started dating another man who was more than twice her age, 52-year-old Ray, who she lived with at Daytona Beach. On May 20th, 1981, after a fight, she stormed off with a gun in her purse, cracked open a 6-pack of beer, swallowed a handful of prescription pills, had a swig of Southern Comfort, and headed for Mosquito Lagoon, where it is speculated that she was going to shoot herself again. But, along the way, she decided to stop by Maik Market, stumbling out of a Ford station wagon wearing only a bikini and heading straight for the snack aisle. When she reached the cashier, she realized that paying for the chips and snacks would mean opening her purse and exposing her gun. So to avoid any assumptions about her, she instead decided to whip the gun out defensively and commit armed robbery, scoring herself 2 packets of cigarettes and $35 from the till. As she headed back to her car, the manager called the police and, as luck would have it, Eileen's car broke down just a few blocks away, where she was apprehended and arrested. On May 4th, 1982, she was sentenced to 3 years in prison, but was released on June 30th, 1983, just 13 months later. In a letter written to the judge, she explained her thought process, which seemed to earn her some brownie points and an early release. "I stepped out of the car pretty darn drunk now and walked in, then remembered I had the darn gun in my purse. And after I buy the potato chips, the clerk's going to possibly notice the pistol. Then out of the blue, not thinking of the consequences I could face doing this, I thought, what would Ray do if I was caught robbing a store? If he loved me enough and helped me out of the mess I'm about to get in, then I'd know he'd truly care." Her borderline personality disorder contributed to this way of thinking, where she felt it necessary to test people's love and boundaries to see how much they valued her. However, if someone were not mentally ill themselves, or if they had any self-respect, they would not have played these toxic games with her, and it seemed that Ray had no interest in doing so. He commented, "I think the girl basically was clean until she hit that Jiffy store. I think that's when she went to pieces." Ray clearly didn't know all that much about her. Eileen had been in pieces since she was a little girl. When she was released from prison, she hit the streets and was back to business. It seemed that prison had hardened her to some degree, maybe even made a smarter criminal out of her in the sense that she had started a more intentional criminal career than ever before. She forged checks, stole guns and ammunition, committed auto theft, and upped her prostitution game with a side hustle of thievery. Forensic psychologist Dr. David Holmes made the observation that she would have realized how chaotic her life and crimes had been when she was in prison, surrounded by mostly organized criminals. In prison, she also learned about the companionship that women could offer her, which she had not experienced much before. Based on her activities with boys and men since she was a young girl, she was often judged, isolated, and cast aside by other females. Nurturing and comforting companionship was not something that she had ever sought out before, but a seed had been planted in her mind. In 1984, she met a woman named Toni, and as one might expect from Eileen's relationship patterns, she fell deeply in love. For someone with BPD, love can be the most intoxicating experience, especially when there is a sense of attachment and intimacy involved. It's that all-in or all-out approach, that rocky road, the kind of love that women usually seek out in bad boys. When someone was able to worm their way into Eileen's heart, she gave it all to them without question, which unfortunately totally blinded her to their true nature or intent. Before long, Toni had taken off with everything that they owned, including the business and its equipment that she had invested all her money in. Less than 2 years later, while still thugging it on the streets and using her body to make a living, Eileen met Tyria, the second woman that she would fall madly in love with and want to invest all of her time, money, mind, and soul in. Tyria knew just how to push her buttons, which Eileen may have experienced as knowing her and loving her. She motivated her to pursue new clients, applauded her worth by saying that she should demand more money, and nudged her out of the door each day to go out there and make the cash that they needed to live happily ever after. Eileen must have felt like a celebrity when she left the house, with her ego inflated and her beady eyes sparkling with determination for the day of work ahead. When she was little, she watched as her grandmother talked of white window shutters, big trees in the backyard, and pretty little flower beds. The only thing that prevented her grandmother from having her dream home was money, and since Eileen had a proactive way of getting her hands on that without delay, she was eager to earn enough to make a forever home with Tyria, maybe even one that her grandmother would have been proud of. And of course, she had no problem with Tyria just sitting at home and watching TV all day. In fact, that likely soothed her fear of abandonment. If she could have, she probably would have locked her in the house all day every day, knowing for sure that she would be there when she got back. For people suffering with BPD, certainty can be a very comforting thing, especially in relationships. Eileen told her friend Dawn that she had never thought of herself as a lesbian, but that Tyria offered her the sisterhood that she had always wanted. Tyria was also very butch and liked to strut around like the man of the house, where Eileen would optimistically bring her gifts, like men's coats, a briefcase, and the diamond ring off the finger of one of her victims. In Tyria, she had found the perfect blend of masculinity and femininity in one person, someone who could be her anchor, who carelessly drifted along with her as she scrambled to make things work, and who would never betray her, or so she thought. In many ways, Tyria was the calm to Eileen's storm, always by her side, always there to testify about the events that occurred when her temper was flaring, and feigning just enough of a protective side to make Eileen believe that she was there for her through thick and thin. Once she had opened up to her about murdering someone and robbing them, she must have felt a rush of excitement when Tyria stuck by her, telling her all the things she wanted to hear, to stay safe, to always carry a gun, to clean the car should anything like that ever happen again, and to make sure that above all she protected herself from harm. To Eileen, this must have felt like the green light to keep doing what she was doing. to some extent projecting the twisted approval that she craved from maternal and paternal figures her entire life onto Tyria. It's quite chilling to study photographs of Eileen's biological father and Tyria Moore side by side. While she had never met or known her own father, they look eerily similar. One can't say how seeing a photograph of her father had impacted her mind as a child. Whether it's a coincidence or not, the resemblance is uncanny. By the time Eileen was 33 years old, she was haggard, frustrated, and had gained a lot of weight from her lifestyle with Tyria. She was no longer as attractive to men as she was used to, and it made her work even more challenging, and her dreams feel as if they were slipping away from her. She also said that most of her regular clients had gone to serve in the US Army in preparation for Operation Desert Storm, the Gulf War. So consistent money was even more difficult to get than before. She was at ground zero again and needed to find an easier way to survive. She started to lash out at her clients in frustration, eventually snapping when Richard Mallory, her first victim, crossed the line. All that she wanted was to get rich and make Tyria happy. She was done trying to find alternative careers, done trying to negotiate her prices with men, and done working so hard for so little reward. In her inebriated mind, it was far more efficient to rob men of their money, cars, clothing and possessions, and wipe them out as witnesses. It also helped her get home to Tyria faster, this time bearing gifts and wads of cash, something that she knew would make her happy. All she had to do was put the key in the ignition, speed off, and hope that the body was undiscovered in the wild for long enough for decomposition to do its trick. During that time of her life, Eileen was drinking more than ever, which contributed to her deteriorating reasoning and conduct. For 6 months, she held her breath until she realized that she had actually managed to get away with murder. Maybe her observation that these scumbags weren't even missed, a false assumption, helped her to know that her selection process was accurate. It all seemed to be working, and for a while, she must have felt quite clever. In May, she murdered another victim, and in June, she optimistically murdered two. With four murders under her belt, she was getting comfortable with the process, murdering one in July, one in September, and one in November. If she hadn't been stopped, Eileen likely would have continued this cycle repeatedly, much like Ted Bundy, who murdered one victim per month once his MO had been perfected. This was one of the reasons that Eileen rose to fame as America's first female serial killer, because for the first time, a female was not killing a companion, but strangers at a consistent pace without any remorse or any sign of slowing down. On death row, she admitted that she would have killed again and again, and there is no doubt in anyone's mind, as soft a spot as they have for her in their heart, that she would have. She was a serial killer. As much as she did not like the label and did not feel as organized as many of her peers in the same category. However, in her murders, she was more organized than she had been in most things in her life, mapping out specific locations, calculating who would be the easiest to rob and kill, creating a variety of aliases to help her new biz thrive, and abandoning cars in separate locations from the bodies. For the first time in her life, she had everything that she wanted. Love, money, and a home with pets, cable TV, and a fridge full of beer. And in typical self-sabotaging behavior, she chose to do something that would take that all away by the time she was 35 years old. And this time, she would be paying for it with her life. Eileen had manipulated her way through life and thought that if she explained herself, the police would understand, much like the judge understood when she first went to prison. In her confession tapes, she spoke so openly that the police had to remind her that she had the right to remain silent, even though they sat in awe of how much she was willing to tell them, clearly thinking that she could buddy up with them and get herself out of yet another mess. But this mess was different, and yet she did not ever seem to understand why, believing that the total cost of her actions was losing Tyria. Not her life, not her freedom, but just the love of her life. The only time we ever saw her cry was when they played the conversations between her and Tyria in court. On one hand, she was devastated that the one person that she had trusted had betrayed her, but on the other, it was as if she was reliving the tragedy of premeditated abandonment, meaning The feelings that she felt as she realized that Tyria was right. They had to break up, and she had to confess to dutifully protect her. This is where she developed empathy for Jesus Christ, angrily telling the cameras that she knew exactly how he felt when society had turned against him. In her mind, she was a martyr for Tyria, and later believed that she had also unwillingly served the purpose of making other people rich and famous. On death row, Eileen's psychological structure was no different. She still suffered from symptoms of BPD and had escalating paranoia, which was to be expected once she was isolated in a cage. Her narrative of events shifted, depending on who she was talking to and what outcome she wanted to meet, which was also likely affected by her lack of identity now that she did not have Tyria or any solid attachments to exist with. The typical BPD pattern of idealizing and demonizing people was evident right until she died. Where she connected with and withdrew from the people who gave her the time of day, including her friend Dawn Botkins. When Dawn had offered to visit her in the weeks leading up to her execution, she angrily rejected the idea, saying that she was tired, needed to prepare for her death, and would only allow the media to visit her. In Eileen's mind, this made perfect sense, but to Dawn, this was the cruel discard that some people in close contact with someone with BPD can experience. While Dawn was the person who was chosen to share a final meal with her, Eileen seemed more intent on what she could do for her, which meant bringing in some special, unorthodox food and telling her crooked cop story to the entire world. Dawn was clearly an empathic person who loved Eileen unconditionally and still does. But people like Eileen tend to be parasitic around those who are genuinely kind and would do anything for them, taking full advantage of them for as long as possible. Eileen was so convinced that the staff at BCI were poisoning her food and plotting to kill her that she wrote a 25-page letter to a judge to bring it to his attention. She told Nick Broomfield that if she did not wash off her food, she almost died, and that she believed they were using sonic pressure. One has to wonder what she read or watched to latch onto that phrase, on her mind, to control her. Her time on death row did not do her mental health any good. She was in solitary confinement by default, refusing to mingle with any other inmates to the point where she gave up cigarettes to stay isolated. She wondered about her life and tried to shift the blame anywhere that she could, which is common in inmates of serious offenses, such as serial murder. One psychologist who had analyzed John Wayne Gacy had said that if he were able to process what he had done, he would have killed himself, and so, out of survival, he concocted elaborate theories of being framed and manipulated, exactly the way that Eileen did. To think that she believed that sheriffs were dropping out of the sky from helicopters and framing her as a serial killer just so that they could get rich off book and movie deals is sad. She had to find a way to still believe that she was special and keep her mind somewhat intact after everything she had done and everyone she had lost. The pain of her detached mother had become a source of insanity that she could no longer ignore. This is evident by her outburst when Nick Broomfield mentioned that he had visited her mother. Instead of saying, "Oh, I don't really know her," Eileen was infuriated at the mention of her, viciously defending her right to never forgive her for abandoning her, and ensuring that the cameras captured exactly how she felt about the person who was supposed to love and protect her. As simplistic as it may seem, the bonds with our biological mothers and fathers are of utmost importance, and when that fails in childhood, one can expect to suffer in one way or another in later life, unless therapy is actively pursued and initiated. Eileen died in a mentally ill, suicidal state, disguised as a willingness to be welcomed on another planet, where she would recolonize, or where she would be accepted into heaven with open arms, welcomed by the father figure that she never had. She took one look at the witnesses at her execution and just knew that they were life-sucking devil workers. But as always, she had found a way to manipulate herself out of a mess, at least in her mind. Her last words were unfathomable, where she had mentally collided Star Trek with the Bible, leaving the world with a threatening language that she was used to dishing out. "I'll be back. I'll be back." Her imagination had dreamt up a scenario where she would come back to Earth in an extraterrestrial invasion, probably to nuke everyone, as she said, with Jesus personally selecting her as his sidekick, as they returned to Earth to shock, scare, and annihilate anyone who had ever doubted them. She probably had not realized that she had competition, based on how many serial killers before her had taken the very same road as her in their time on death row.